Happy to bring in our brother, first time as a married man, Chris Biederman, back here with us. Let's actually get some air horns for him.
Yes, sir.
Got the fresh haircut, looking great here on the live stream, man. Lots to talk about. Let's start with the 49ers. We'll get to the Kings here in just a few minutes. I know you have been doing some great work covering the 49ers over at the Candlestick Chronicles podcast with our man Kyle Mattson. I felt like Kyle was kind of on the draft. How do you feel like the 49ers did last weekend?
I think pretty good. I think what they did was they addressed a lot of their needs, and they did it early and often, particularly on the defensive line, which I think was smart. It didn't feel like, you know, there was no Jake Moody, Cam Latu kind of screw ups, right? Like there was, when you look at all the picks, I think you can say, yeah, maybe they reached a little bit for Nick Martin, the third round linebacker, or Upton Stout, third round nickel corner. But if they have belief that those guys are going to have contributing roles, it's like, it doesn't matter if they're third round or fifth round picks. Like if they're starters, they're starters. So I think you can quibble, I guess, with the value of some of their picks, but they didn't draft any guys with the exception of the quarterback they took from Indiana in the seventh round. They didn't draft anybody coming in with injuries. They didn't draft anybody with like serious character concerns or red flags. It seemed like they were just hitting a bunch of singles and doubles. And they just need as much depth on the roster as they can get. And it feels like at minimum they did that. And, you know, there's a chance with Mykel Williams, with Alfred Collins, that those guys can pop and potentially be long-term starters. I do believe in their upside. And if they get coached up, I think the Niners defense could potentially be good going forward. So I like a lot of the picks. I don't love every single pick, but as far as like what the bar is for them, it looks a lot better than the Jake Moody, Cam Latu draft for sure.
It's interesting you bring up Nick Martin, because that's one of the guys that stood out to me on the defensive end. I feel like there's a formula that John Lynch is going for with there, and he using a prototype of Dre Greenlaw as that formula. He wants another Dre Greenlaw type next to Fred Warner. Does Nick Martin kind of replicate some of the things that Dre does as far as being an athlete? I think Dre Greenlaw is maybe a harder hitter, but as far as the speed, it feels like that's what he was trying to replicate with Nick Martin.
Yeah, it looked like speed was really a priority on defense. Speed more than size, particularly with Nick Martin and Stout and Siegel, the fifth-round safety they got from K-State. You watch him play, and I don't know if it's just an optical illusion because he was wearing the number 4, but the way he runs around, he looks like a DB. And I know he's listed at 220 pounds. I think Fred Warner's like 226 or something like that in his playing weight. So the weight for a linebacker isn't as much of a thing as it was, you know, like a decade ago when Patrick Willis and those dudes were like 240, 250 pounds. But yeah, I think, you know, a question I would have, like, all right, CJ West, you're trying to approximate DJ Jones, right? Nick Martin, you're trying to approximate Dre Greenlaw. Upton Stout, you're trying to approximate Kaywan Williams. I'm not saying that's faulty logic because it obviously worked with those dudes, but are you trying to like replicate templates of dudes, or are you just trying to find good players? Yeah. Right. Like that would be a question I have. And I think that's kind of nitpicking a little bit. But yeah, I think Nick Martin has the potential to be that dude, especially when you watched him in 2023, he was flying around. He made a ton of tackles. There are questions about, you know, does he overrun plays? And does he miss too many tackles? And you had the same sort of questions about Quan Alexander back in the day, right? When the Niners added him. So I think it makes sense. It's definitely a big swing. It seemed like he was probably going to be available in the fourth or fifth round. But again, you don't know that. But if they have conviction on the guy that he's a third round pick and potential starter, then I don't really have any problem with that.
You feel like they missed anything over the weekend? Maybe not on a player, but maybe a position.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking they need a center all offseason. I'm not a big Jake Brendel guy. I don't blame them for not, you know, like the offensive line thing and trying to find a replacement for Trent Williams. You're only going to do that with a real premium pick, right? Like you're not going to find a Trent Williams replacement in the third round. Or if you do, you're going to get extremely lucky. Like, So I think kind of what they did with the defensive line in this year's draft, they're probably likely to do with the offensive line in next year's draft. And yeah, could they have used a guard? For sure. Could they have used a potential swing tackle? For sure. You saw him get DJ Humphries yesterday, 31 years old, didn't play a lot of football last year, only played 2 games for the Chiefs. But has played good football in his career, but at this point, it's probably a stretch to, like, if Trent Williams does have to miss significant time, do you feel great about DJ Humphries as a backup? I don't know. You might feel better about a developmental, swing tackle type, but you look at the picks they made, they had more pressing needs. Like these guys, Nick Martin could potentially start at weak side linebacker. The defensive linemen, all three of those rookies could potentially start and or play a lot. Their rookie season. So if they had drafted a tackle, it might have been a swing tackle, and it might have been somebody who doesn't start for you this year. So with that logic, you'd say, they had more pressing needs on defense. But if there is a critique, I would say they could really use an upgrade at center. They could definitely use a developmental tackle, a potential starting guard. But even with 11 picks, it's tough to hit every single need that you have.
Two of the very, very, very few offensive skill players that they took in this draft, because they did, somebody was joking, they just locked Kyle Shanahan in a closet somewhere and just went all defense. Jordan Watkins, the wide receiver out of Ole Miss, and Jordan James, the running back out of Oregon. Do you think we see either one of these guys get a real shot at being part of the offense? I know Jordan James might get a look because they kind of cleared out the running back room this past offseason. Do you think either one of them might be part of the plans immediately?
Yeah, I think it'll honestly come down to how they are in special teams early on. Because you remember even when Jordan Mason first got his shot at backup running back, it was because of what he did on special teams. And he was active on game days over Ty Davis Price because of what he was able to do on special teams. So for James and Watkins, that's kind of what I expect, or at least that's what I expect their avenue to be towards getting playing time. Cause it's a steep curve and they're joining a team with veterans already at their positions. Now, if Christian McCaffrey misses any time, then I would expect, James to get a look. For sure. I think he was a good pick. Like in another draft where there weren't so many running backs, it wouldn't have surprised me if he would have been a third, fourth round pick. I think he was maybe pushed down the board a little bit because of all the depth at running back in this year's class. Watkins, I don't know. Like there's some serious sort of Danny Gray vibes to me. Ooh. Obviously Danny Gray, a third round pick, didn't work out. Maybe it will. Maybe he'll be different with him. Kyle Shanahan's always looking for a field stretching receiver. You remember what, like Travis Benjamin, what they wanted him to be, just somebody who can stretch the field and create space for everyone else underneath. It feels like that's kind of what they envision for him. But even he said it in his conference call after getting drafted, like it's going to be a steep learning curve, and it always is for rookies, particularly receivers for Kyle Shanahan. So, their way to be active on game days, at least in the rookie year, to me, barring any other injuries, is to stand out on special teams, and that'll ultimately be the deciding factor.
I think I know the answer to this question. We all might know the answer to the question, but like, what now? Like, what's next? Now that the draft is behind us, what are we just waiting for the Schefter Rappaport tweet about a contract extension for Brock Purdy?
Yeah, for sure. That's the whole thing. That's like the biggest thing this offseason, right? It was nailing the draft and then getting the Purdy deal done. And I think getting George Kittle's deal done yesterday was a sign that, all right, this front office is probably tired of all the offseason contract drama that they've had. And I think it's been pretty inarguable that the contract standoffs with Brandon Ayuk and Deebo Samuel and Nick Bosa and Trent Williams and Christian McCaffrey to a certain extent have bled into the following seasons. And I think the 49ers, I would say a priority for them this offseason would be just get these deals done so you don't have to worry about any of this stuff. All your dudes are practicing at training camp. Everyone's on the field. You get done all of the contract work you need to get done so you can focus on the season and not have to deal with these dudes holding out and not practicing until the last week in August or even, the first week of regular season practice going into the season opener. So, yeah, get the Brock Purdy deal done. Like, that's just get it done. It doesn't matter. Like, to me, it doesn't matter if it's $50 million a year, $55 million a year on average. Like, it's the structure of the contract is not going to be what's initially reported. It's going to look crazy initially because that's going to be the maximum value because the agent's going to want, you know, all that money out there. But in reality, Brock Purdy is going to get a big check up front. His cap hit's going to be small probably for the first 2 years, and they'll probably have huge cap hits at the back end, and then it'll be all worked out. It, like, people are going to make a really big deal about the financials of the contract if and when it comes down. And I promise you it won't be that big of a deal because everything's renegotiable, right? You can move around money in these contracts, and the 49ers have been pretty good at that. So get the deal done, you know, have your full team, your full complement of veterans ready for training camp, and then you can hit the ground running.
It's almost like in a video game, whether it's Madden or NCAA football or something like that, where you have a certain amount of time that you can allot to recruiting or negotiating. Mm-hmm. And the Niners have, over the past 3 years, it feels like they've used all their negotiating time. Like, there's no more negotiations. Just sign. That's all you can do is sign. You don't have time to quabble back and forth. I'm with you. Like, just get this done. Let's move forward. I like the signing of George Kittle and what that kind of represents and could potentially mean as well. And also, yeah, with George Kittle, do you think that kind of guarantees he retires as a 49er?
It should. It should. He's signed through 2029. Now, you know, it's likely that, I mean, I don't know how likely it is, but it's through 2029. It's 5 years from now. He's what, 31, 32, given what he's put his body through. Like, he's basically needed surgery on his left shoulder since he came into the league. And he's said that he's not going to get that surgery until he retires. And so, you know, he always plays with that brace on it. I couldn't even tell you, you know, like, I know my guy Eric Branch of the Chronicle is always talking about Kittle's injuries and everything that he's played through. The list is long. He's played through ankles and groins and backs and ribs and all sorts of different shoulders, obviously, all sorts of different stuff. So, yeah, I would imagine that he's going to retire a 49er. I think that's important to him. I think getting on the 10-year wall is important to him. I think he represents sort of everything the 49ers want from, like, their core franchise type players in terms of their professionalism, how they take care of their body, you know, the off-season work ethic, coming into training camp in great shape, ready to roll, practicing really hard. Like, him, Fred Warner, Nick Bosa, like, those guys all kind of exemplify that. And so I think the 49ers are rewarding that, and I think that's mutual on Kittle's side from the standpoint of he wants to be on that 10-year wall, he wants to retire a 49er.
Well, let's shift gears here. Our man Chris Biederman of the Sacramento Bee does a great job covering the San Francisco 49ers over at the Candlestick Chronicles podcast, of course, for the Sacramento Bee as well. Also, spent a great deal of time covering the Sacramento Kings, who have made quite a bit of news over the course of the last couple of weeks. New general manager, Scott Perry. New-ish, officially, head coach, Doug Christie. Let's start with the general manager. That all happened very, very quickly. Monty McNair was out. Scott Perry was in. How did you feel when all of that transpired following the ass whooping at the hands of the Dallas Mavericks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty standard Kings move, I guess. Like, it's, I don't know. How do you guys feel about it? Because, like, if the expectation is, do you want somebody that gets along with the owner, then you check that box, right? If the expectation is we want to be a perennial top four seed or at least top six seed in the Western Conference, I just don't know. I don't have a ton of confidence that Scott Perry's the guy, and that's not necessarily a knock on Scott Perry. It's a knock on, you know, what's been a decision making process within the Kings organization that's been questionable for a long time now. Obviously, it's the fact that, you know, you look at Scott Perry as a GM with the Knicks. In first year, 29 wins, 17 wins, 21 wins. You know, they had won 41 wins in 2020 and 2021. Won only one playoff game, lost in the first round to the Hawks. 37 and 45 the next year. They bring in Rick Brunson and Leon Rose. Then you bring in Jalen Brunson. And then, you know, you make your run in the playoffs and beat the Cavs. Scott Perry's not retained. I just, you know, It doesn't seem to me that the Scott Perry thing inspires a ton of confidence in terms of, you know, is he going to be somebody that overrules Vivek when he needs to be overruled? And I don't know if any GM is going to be that guy until Vivek decides to relent some of that power, frankly. So I don't know. If Vivek does what he did when Mike Brown was first hired and kind of takes his hands off the wheel and lets Monty McNair and Mike Brown run the ship, like the, when they were the three seed in 22-23, then I think Scott Perry has a much better chance at success. If Vivek is going to be the one really making all these decisions, then it's hard for me to have a lot of confidence in that because of what recent history tells us, and that Vivek is not great at making these basketball decisions. So we'll have to see. I will say, I think retaining Doug without a real exhaustive search indicates to me that Vivek is still making these decisions. And so that doesn't inspire a ton of confidence, and that's nothing against Doug. But, you know, we'll have to see. We'll have to see how it all works out. We'll have to see what roster changes are made. They obviously need to make a bunch of roster changes. And if they don't, then, you know, it's hard to go into next season with any real expectations, but aside from being a fringe, you know, playoff play-in type team. And if that's what they want, then they can achieve that goal. But if they want to be a top six, perennial top six team, then they do need to make some significant changes.
I always ask these questions, and it always comes off as I'm the Vivek apologist or whatever.
You are.
But I'll ask you, Chris, what decisions did Vivek Ranadive make that he overruled the general manager?
It sounds like firing Mike and trading for Zach LaVine.
Okay, that's two. And
pretty big ones.
Yeah, but that's also after not doing that for 2 years. According to everything we heard, he's wanted Zach LaVine for a long time. They said no. Monty McNair said, no, we're not going after him. It'll be bad. All right, fall back. Listen to you, Monty. I think the story goes, we don't have a clear indication on this, is Vivek, I don't know if he wanted to fire Mike Brown, but he didn't want to give him the extension over the summer. And Monty and all these, no, this is what we need to do, da-da-da-da. All right, fine, go ahead. And when they were wrong, dead-ass wrong, that's when he came in and said, all right, man, like these last 2 years, we've regressed under your leadership. I'm probably going to fire you, so I'm going to do what I need to do. And the thing about it is, like, if he was doing this with a good GM, it'd be one thing. But Monty, and I defended Monty a lot, and I understand some of the reasons why things didn't happen, but the reality is he was bad at his job. I'd step in, too. For somebody that was bad at their job, he didn't improve that roster, and every decision he made to not go get somebody or to keep somebody around failed. So
I think sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, I would probably put DeMar DeRozan under the Vivek umbrella. It doesn't seem like a money move, and it's been reported.
But I wish you'd tell the whole story. Was it, don't look at anybody else, get DeMar DeRozan at all costs, or it was, hey, if you can't close these deals that you tell me that are out here, at the very least, you need to go get this guy.
We know there was at least one.
Where he couldn't get the deal done.
Well, there was no deal to get done.
Well, he couldn't.
Deal to get done in terms of Lauri Markkanen.
He couldn't get a deal done. I'm not saying.
I hear you. It was a fictitious deal. Like, that wasn't. Danny Ainge wasn't going to do a deal with Sacramento. They wasn't going to do a deal, period.
Sure, for sure. But what I'm saying is, we get to July 3rd, and Monty hasn't done anything. He said, all right, man, you haven't done anything. Like, go get this guy.
Mm-hmm.
We've been out of the playoffs since mid-April. You've had since mid-April to July 1st to figure something out, and we have nothing. Yeah, go get this guy. I don't think, like, I don't want to say, like, he should do it. I wouldn't advise him to do that. But, bro, you hadn't done nothing. You didn't do nothing at the trade deadline. We didn't improve this team at all. Like, I'm sick of you.
That's all fair. That's definitely all fair.
I'm sick of you is a wild thing for Vivek to say to Monty. I'm sick of you.
I would just say, look, given the history of the Kings, there's been one constant, right, for all this, and it's the ownership, right? So you can have, you know, we can quibble about Monty's moves and Mike's coaching and stuff. Like, to me, you know, it never felt like Mike got the guys that Mike wanted to get. So, you know, and there's a bunch of other stuff to that. And that's, you know, we could talk about that for hours and hours and hours.
We can, but all I'm saying is, did Vivek keep Mike from getting the guys that he wanted? That's my whole thing.
I've heard some things. I mean, you guys have probably heard the same things. Like, I think it's pretty clear now that there are limitations, particularly defensively, when you're paying Domantas Sabonis what you're paying him, right? So, like, yes, if you're all in on Domantas Sabonis, you need to have your roster a certain way. And I think there are people within the organization that knew that, and I think there are people in the organization that push back on that idea. And I think the disagreements ultimately is the reason why the Kings are where they are. So, you know, if the Kings want to, I think the Kings need to make a big swing. Like, I think where they're at now, like, can you get a distressed asset? Like, can you buy low on Ja Morant? Can you buy low on Zion Williamson? I know Giannis is the guy that we're all going to be talking about this offseason.
Yeah, you're not buying low on him, though.
No, you're not buying low on him. And I don't know if the Kings have the assets to get him even. But, like, to me, they got to make a big swing. And I think everybody has to be on the table. But, yeah, like, the revisionist history stuff, like, you know, like, I'm of the opinion that they never should have fired Mike. Like, yeah, it was a 5-game losing streak. And, yeah, like, the team was underperforming. But I think that was a roster issue more than a Mike Brown issue, if I'm being honest. And ultimately, the decision to fire Mike led to De'Aaron officially wanting out. So that's just my opinion. But water under the bridge at this point. Scott Perry's got Zach LaVine on a big contract. He's got Domantas Sabonis on a big contract. He's got a team that just lost in the play-in at home to a decimated Mavericks team. And we'll see, you know, what type of foundation that is to work with. But I think they definitely got their work cut out for them if they want to build this into something that, you know, is a top 6 seed year in and year out going forward.
You think Scott Perry will have the freedom to conduct business the way he sees fit?
Maybe initially. Maybe initially. I don't know. I mean, there's not a ton of history that says Vivek is willing to let someone else take full control of the wheel for longer than a year. So we'll see. But yeah, I don't have a ton of confidence that he's going to allow that to happen. And again, like, we've heard that, like, Doug Christie's been in the building for a long time. We know he's been a favorite of the organization for a long time. The fact that he was hired without a real exhaustive search and looking at, you know, throughout the league for potential high level assistants or anyone else would indicate to me that Vivek still very much has his hand on the wheel.
Well, I definitely think they're doing that. Like, I think they're searching for high-level assistance. I actually don't have a problem that they didn't do an exhaustive search. Like, what were you going to do? You going to bring Taylor Jenkins in here? Were you going to try to mend fences with Michael Malone? Like, I don't know who the hot coaching prospect is. Like, if Doug is ever going to get a shot at being a head coach, like, it's here. He's earned it, and to me, he's, like, earned it. Sure. I'm okay that they didn't do the exhaustive search. I do hope that there was a level of truth to what Scott Perry said, though, when he was like, no, there's a few people who've called, you know, I've talked to a few people around the league about this job, and I'm going to continue to talk to them. I hope that that's true. Mm-hmm. And that he did have conversations with other people. And, you know, the way I've always framed it, Chris, or the way I've always wondered is if it was like, hey, Scott, you have full autonomy to do whatever you want. Like, you are in charge of the coaching search. We really like Doug. We would like to be Doug. We would like to see Doug at the top of your list. Now, if you have someone who you feel like is a better fit for Sacramento who can take us where we want to go, by all means, let's talk about it. But going into this, we'd like for you to have a strong consideration for Doug Christie.
And real quick, the other aspect of that is it's always assumed that Scott Perry doesn't like Doug Christie and doesn't want him as the coach.
Right.
And Vivek made him. And that's unfair.
Right.
I don't know what happened.
Doug and Scott Perry.
Yeah, that's unfair.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. Doug, you know, Doug started out, what, 19 and 10? Like, it was amid all of the circumstances.
You started out like 11 and 1.
right. Yeah. And, you know, amid all the circumstances, you can't take away from the fact that Doug did have a winning record. I would, you know, so it's just when you have a coaching search, like, I refuse to believe that there aren't some high level assistants somewhere that we don't know about that you can't even bring in for interviews. Like, I haven't seen reports of any interviews for head coaching jobs. You know what I mean? Like,
no.
And like, you know, there's no harm in interviewing, casting a wide net, interviewing people. And if it was, you know, we cast a wide net, we looked at all the high level assistants from the best staffs in Miami and OKC and, you know, all these well-coached teams, and then you'd settle on Doug Christie, it's like, okay, I'd feel pretty good about that. But it doesn't, it seems like, and the reporting was, even when Monty was fired, was that Doug Christie's in the driver's seat for the head coaching job. It seems like they were just settled on Doug without casting that wide net. And so, you know, if Doug, maybe Doug's a great coach, and maybe Doug is ends up being what Rick Adelman was. But I would just say, like, I think they did themselves a little bit of disservice by not at least casting a wide net to see how Doug stacked up against the rest of this, the rest of these candidates, rather than just hiring him on the spot.
I understand. Mm-hmm. Chris, we appreciate you, man. Great to catch up as always. I know we'll be touching base a lot as these two off seasons move along here, man. Appreciate you.
Yeah, appreciate you guys. Thanks for having me.
That's a man, Chris Biederman, right there. The Sacramento Bee and Candlestick Chronicles. Check out his great work all year long covering the San Francisco 49ers and all things. Didn't get a chance to talk about the A's. Shoot.
Damn.
Maybe next time. Too.